Maybe you saw the news where there's a young woman named Syd, C-Y-D, who works with a humanitarian group in Afghanistan that was just taken hostage a couple of weeks ago in Afghanistan. I saw it in the Sunday paper. She's a Christian. She works with a humanitarian group there in Afghanistan, and I've been following that story. And so if you would pray for her, there was an interesting news release that said last week 500 women in the city where she was, 500 women fully clothed in their burqas protested her kidnapping with signs and with songs. And that's pretty amazing in Afghanistan, for women to take to the streets and protest the kidnapping of this woman who they consider to be someone there just to help them and to work with the people of Afghanistan. So if you would pray for her. Her name is Syd, C-Y-D, and I'm sure if you go to Voice of the Martyrs, I'm not saying she's a martyr. I hope she's not going to be one. But they may have information on her if you want to keep up and pray for her. Which brings us to our topic today. As we talk about passionate faith on display, let me remind you, since we've been off a week, where we were. We are, in our minds, visiting an art gallery. And the visiting exhibit is called Passionate Faith on Display. And we are walking through the hallway of this art gallery, and we are looking at portraits of significant women whose lives, whose ministries, whose contributions to the church, little c, to Christian history, has made a difference and made a significant impact in our own story, in who we are. And so there are so many of these women to choose from. We have such a heritage, and I grieve over the fact that I think in the free church tradition, Bible Church, Baptist, so many of those kinds of churches, we don't emphasize these people in churches. We don't know who they are, so we don't know anything about them. But they are our spiritual mentors from afar. They teach us something. They show us the way. They have a testimony, a witness to give to us and show us something through their lives. And so we're looking at these women, what they did, what was so important, what was their significant contribution, and then looking at Christ, what he did, and seeing what the New Testament tells us then that we need to do as we follow those examples. And so today I'm talking about two women. I'm going to have to really talk fast because I couldn't decide between the two. So you know how it is. You can't decide between two dresses at Dillard's. So what do? You buy both. Yeah. So that's what I'm doing. I know you understand that reasoning. So I'm doing the Catherines today, two women that lived about 500 years apart, but who were so similar in their lives and their calling. The first one is Catherine of Siena, the second one, Catherine Booth. Now, the Catherines were portraits in compassion. They were noted and looked at today for their compassionate work among the poor, the lowly, the oppressed, the uneducated, taking their time, their ministries, risking their health, as we will see, to minister to those, to the helpless, to those who could give nothing back to them. And I think it's interesting that when we look at the lives of these women, we see that people were so drawn to them. And as I was reading over their stories, it reminded me of why people were so drawn to Jesus. Why? Because of his compassion and his empathy. And he would stop and talk to the lowest of persons, would he not? The most insignificant person that had no ranking in that culture of that day, he would stop and talk to and listen. He was known for his compassion. And so I want us to think of today about compassion. Now, usually when we think about compassion, we think of, you know, you see the... Remember when they would have all those commercials on television about feed the children and show the babies with the big stomachs and the flies on their faces? You remember that? And you just... It's just so awful to look at. You want to look away because it's just so awful. And it would bring feelings of pity and sorrow. And then it would have a number for you to call. But compassion is more than just empathy. The best definition that I read several definitions. I like this. It's more than feeling sorrow or pity for someone. It is empathy in action. It is feelings of sorrow and grief and pity, but then that results in action, not just saying that's so awful and turning around and walking off. And when you think about Jesus, isn't that what every time, and I challenge you, if you don't believe me, to look in your concordance under compassion, and I found 5 or 6 instances where Jesus, the scripture says, he was moved with compassion. He felt compassion. He saw them and he felt compassion. And every time he felt compassion, something happened. He did something. He preached a message to them. He performed a miracle. He stopped and ministered to them in some way. His feelings of compassion did just not end there with, oh, that's so sad. His feelings of compassion ended with some kind of action. And that is what we see in the Catharines today, and I think that is our challenge. Now, compassion doesn't come easily to everyone. You know, not everyone has just the bleeding heart, as we say. I have 2 daughters, and the older one is very black and white, get to the point, bossy, you know, just not emotional. The second one is just big-hearted, soft-hearted, you know, just feel sorry for everybody and everything. Well, I remember one day years ago sitting at the table, and I was telling them a story of a friend of mine whose daughter had gotten into bad trouble with drugs in the wrong crowd, and it was really a heartbreaking story. And I was sitting there telling the story, and my younger daughter, Holly, she has these big brown eyes, and she had these tears just spilling over, you know, just what, and she said, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? How can we help them? How can we help her? And I looked over at Wendy, my other daughter, who was sitting like this, and she said, it's her own fault. She has no one to blame but herself. I don't know why I have to do something. So we had a little lecture on compassion. Not that it did much good, but I do recognize that compassion doesn't come easily to everybody, but I want to tell you that it is a sign of the Christ life. And so if you don't naturally have it, you need to cultivate it, and you need to work on that in your life, because it is a characteristic that Christ had, that these women had, and it is part of seeing people as God sees people. I think that's a good definition of compassion also. Seeing others as God sees them. Not with presuppositions or prejudices or biases or it's their own fault, but seeing them for their own condition. Now, these two women were known for their work among the poor. Catherine of Siena was born in Tuscany, Italy, 14th century, 1347. She was the 24th child out of 25 children. Yes, people, think about that for a while. Born into a middle class during a time when there was a transition from feudal society to economic democracy, so to speak, and it was a time of a lot of social upheaval. Now, let me say something about these women, and really all the women that we talk about. I think when you study historical figures like this, you find some odd things that they did. You know, some things that are very much out of our tradition that we don't understand, especially Catherine of Siena. She's some weird stuff. She was a mystic. She was a medieval mystic. And these people would have visions and raptures and go into ecstasies, and they would always want to identify with the sufferings of Christ, and they would do self-denial self-deprivation to an extent that you and I could not even imagine. But my point, I don't ever want to get to the point where I judge them and say that's right or wrong. That's not the point. I'm just going to tell you what they did, right? This is what their life was like. This is what they did within the context of their time. And it's not up to us to say whether it was right or wrong. It's just what happened. She was a true mystic. When she was 7, age 7, She felt that she had had a visitation from the Holy Spirit, and she announced her determination to have a religious life. She did not want to marry or have children. Her parents tried to persuade her differently, but she would not do it. And she had this familiar image you will often see in medieval mystics of going into raptures or ecstasies during prayer, seeing visions of Christ. And this was, she would write a lot of these. She wrote a book called Dialogues, in which she recorded a lot of her mystical visions. But the interesting thing about Catherine is that even though she would live alone in a little house and deprive herself of food and sleep and all of these other things, that's not all she did. She didn't just devote her life to contemplation or to activity, but to both. And so she would have these experiences, but they always led her to service. And that's one reason I like her. She just didn't stay by herself for 25 years and not have anything to do with anybody. All of her experiences drove her to minister to the poor and the sick. She had, her theology basically had 3 points. Her big thing was truth, virtue, and love. And this was what she preached and taught wherever she went. Serving the poor. She took the third way, which they called was you didn't really go into a convent, there were form orders, but you could preach to people and you could perform services. So she directed at home, and she learned to read and write with another priest who taught her to read and write. For 4 years, the first 4 years she did this, she dedicated her life to serving the poor and the oppressed. Now, 4 years later, Europe was hit by the Black Death, or the bubonic plague. And this, you may remember from world history, was one of the worst scourges of the earth. And 1/3 of the population of the world was killed, from Iceland to India. Started with a flea that was probably on the back of a rat that came into port in Italy, and it just spread like wildfire. The symptoms were, because you're eating lunch, I'm not going to tell you all the symptoms. Headaches, aches, rapid pulse, slurring of speech, fatigue, apathy, swelling of lymph nodes, tissues would swell, causing hemorrhaging, collapse of the nervous system, terrible pain, and then the last stage, your skin would blacken, and that was called, why it was called Black Death. Now, this quote was given by a historian. People went to bed healthy and were found dead in the morning. Priests and doctors who came to care for the sick would contact the plague with a single touch and die sooner than the person they had come to help. So because of that, you can see how people were so hesitant to visit, wouldn't you? Yes. They didn't know what to do because even the slightest contact, it was so contagious. But Catherine miraculously was able to, truly miraculously, avoid this illness. And for several years, she worked among the poor and the dying of the Black Plague. She says, I built myself an inner cell in my soul where I would minister from that place. And somehow God gave me the grace to not see the awful physical conditions and the smell. Somehow she was able to hold people's hands while they were dying. Well, there's one account that said she would just go all day long just holding people's hands or heads in her hand until they died. And she'd put them down, cover their face, go to the next one. Somehow she did this. 80,000 people died in that outbreak of the plague, and there were other outbreaks. She lost her sister, a brother, 8 nieces and nephews. She would go without food, drink, sleep for days to minister to the smallest way to the sick and dying, praying over them, holding their hands until they died. But interestingly enough, her concern for the physical and emotional well-being of people was not just limited to the physical, but of course to the spiritual, because as a believer, she understood that while it was so very important to alleviate suffering here in the world, what was more important? A person's spiritual destiny. That was more important than even their physical needs. And so her love for others, her compassion for their poverty of spirit, as well as sick and poverty-stricken lives, drove her to serve in a way of preaching. She would go on crusades, and that's what they call them. And just remember, in the terminology of the day, the Middle Ages, crusades were very accepted. That was a very accepted term, to go and preach a crusade. And she was given permission by the priests in her local area to go, and she went on a crusade to Pisa, Italy, and she would go places, and crowds would gather because they had heard of her, and she would talk about Christ and present the plan of salvation. She was unafraid of that. And not only that, she is also known for her reforms, pushing for reforms in the church. Now, this was just prior to the Reformation. And there had been a big schism in the Catholic Church, where there were actually two capitals, two Vaticans, if you want to call it that. The French government got involved, the state government. There was no separation of state and church, remember. And so they had moved Rome, or the head of the Catholic Church, to France. And so there were about 40 years you had these two warring, you had Rome and France arguing. It's Catholic history, and I don't understand it. And it doesn't matter, except that she just went off on this, and she would write these letters. You should read these letters. She's saying, these people are poor and dying. You are taxing them to death. You are taking money for indulgences, and they don't have money to feed their children. She just was relentless in her. And these men would write her letters back and say, basically, shut up. You are a woman. Go away. And she wouldn't do it. I know, that's why we like her. And she just kept on. And there's records of her. You can read her letters and her writings challenging the Pope, saying, what are you doing up there in France? Get back down here. We got things to do besides your petty little art power plays and your arguments. She criticized the church's expenditures for luxuries that were paid by the taxation of the poor. She condemned the vices of all the immorality that was going on. She prayed and worked for justice. She was criticized for meddling in church affairs, and she was criticized for promoting missions. She told them, you need to get home, and instead of having your arguments about that, we need to start a work over in this area of the city where no one is ministering to the poor. We need to do this. She was a ball of fire, and she was a reformer as well as a woman known. And she why could she say all that, and why did people listen to her? Because she had gained her credibility by ministering to the poor. She was not too important. She was not. I love that. I love that. That her service was the platform for her ministry for spiritual needs, of ministering to the spiritual needs of people around her. She is one of only three women that is recognized as a doctor of the church in Catholicism. And that is a special position that you are given beyond sainthood, even, a doctor of the church. Her service, her desire for biblical truth. And I want to read you one of her prayers that she prays in her journal, just one of her daily prayers of her quiet time. And tell me if you couldn't pray this yourself today. O Holy Spirit, come into my heart. Draw it by thy power to thee, true God. Grant me love with fear of thee. Guard me from evil thought. Warm me and inflame me with thy love. Holy my Father and sweet my Lord, help me now in all my labors. Christ, you are love. Christ, you are love. That's Catherine of Siena, a really amazing woman who had compassion not only on people's physical needs, but their spiritual as well. Now, about 500 years later, another Catherine came on the scene, Catherine Booth, who is known as the Mother of the Salvation Army. She was born in 1829 in England, Christian parents, married William Booth, who was a preacher, and they established the Salvation Army. They felt a calling to the poor, and he was a pastor, and they would go out to teach and preach and pray among the poor and lowly and invite them into the church. And so there's a story about one day he was preaching at the church, and one of the church leaders got up to him and said, you know, we need to stop having these undesirables come into our church. We have a very nice church, and we just don't need those people. And William started to answer, and Catherine was on the front row of the balcony, and she stood up, and she held her fist up, and she said, never, never, never will we ever deny anyone access into the church of Jesus Christ because they are undesirable. And she said to one of her friends sitting late next to her, the more I see a fashionable religion, the more I despise it. Oh, Love that woman. You know, and she was strong. After a few years, William decided he was going to mess with the church. They never did come around to understanding his ministry, so they wanted to start an itinerant ministry, which concerned her. How are they going to live? They had all these eight children, all went into the ministry. And so God provided, and they worked together to establish the Salvation Army. I wish you all could read these stories about Catherine Booth and these women of the temperance movement. This was around the temperance movement time, too. They would just go into these bars. And remember, this was London. There were no child labor laws. There were no labor unions. Women would work 12 hours a day. Children would work. Conditions were horrible. There was such a peasant, poor class. And they would go, and alcoholism was rampant because of the misery of their lives. These women, like Catherine Booth, her Women of the Salvation Army, and these other women in the temperance movement, they would walk into bars with their Bibles, stand in front of a table as if I just came right there, and read the scripture to these drunk men and say, "You bums, you know, you've got a wife, you've got children, they're poor, they're hungry. You have never read." So they had no fear. You want to talk about not afraid to offend? They were not afraid to offend. And really, William Booth came up with, some people have called it, really, it's a social reconstruction plan for a nation that was just burdened with alcoholism and unemployment, poverty, families that were split, uneducated. This man was a visionary like few other men. Catherine was the intellectual one. She was trained in theology and philosophy, and she gave the movement its theological and philosophical basis. They liked the army terms. Here again, that's not something we would use today, but that was big in their day. The military terms, the Salvation Army, there was the general, you know, there was a captain, they had crusades, they had drills, all of their organization was structured around those terms. One of her interests was reclaiming women from a life of prostitution. And she, over a period of something like 10 years, gathered over 350,000 signatures on a petition to the English Parliament, British Parliament, to outlaw prostitution and the slave trade, where these poor girls who had, it's just like today, these girls that have no future, they're taken and sold into slavery. She worked tirelessly to end the white slave trade. She worked for labor laws for women, because there were factories where women did the same amount of work but were paid half the amount of men. Imagine such a thing. And they, one of the big things where all the poor people were match factories. They would make matches. And they would work with phosphorus. Apparently you dip the end of the match in phosphorus. Well, it's very, very, very poisonous and lethal. And these people that worked in these factories would contract these horrible diseases. I'm telling you, it sounds worse than the Black Plague. I don't even want to tell you. It was so awful. The cancer and the illness and the distortion of the neck and the face and the bone that would happen to these people. She and William decide we can think of something better than that. They came up with an alternative way to make matches. And they started their own factory. And somehow they managed to pay the women as much as they did the men. And they didn't use phosphorus. And not only that, but they advertised it about how the phosphorus, how detrimental it was to the health of the women. And the men working in the factory use our matches. And everybody's happy. And they put the old match factory out of business. Do you love it? It's so great. They had no fear and no end to the means they would go to alleviate the suffering of others. Interestingly enough, that the Salvation was the only, it's one of the few large institutions that welcomed women preachers. And I have to say that just because I think it's so interesting. She would go, they would separate on Sunday morning. William Booth would go one way, she'd go the other, and they would gather crowds and they would preach the gospel. When they came to America, William Booth chose, he called them his splendid seven women that he thought could bring, and they did, the Salvation Army to America, get it organized. And when they were getting on the ship to go over, he prayed, "Lord," he said, "these ladies are going to America to preach the gospel. If they have fully given their lives to thee, be with them and bless them and grant them success. If they're not going to be faithful, just drown them." Now, I don't know how those ladies felt about that prayer. You know, I might have thought, better catch up on my quiet time. And he said, "My best men are women." He was unafraid. He saw no difference there. Interesting. Now, here's the thing that I love about these women. Both of them married compassion for the poor with compassion for spiritual darkness. They did both. What a testimony. They had no fear of ministering to the poor and no fear in proclaiming the gospel and the truth of the Word of God, cared for physical needs and spiritual needs. Now, what does the Bible tell us? We know, everybody here, I'm sure you know, the Bible sets such a precedence on this as far as compassion. In the Old Testament, Amos is a minor prophet. He was just a farmer. He was a nobody. But God chose him to be a prophet at a time when Israel was at its lowest ebb. There was terrible sexual idolatry and sin. There was exploitation of the poor. There was extreme taxation. It was truly one of the darkest times in Israel's history. And Amos's message was justice and compassion. That was his message. We don't have time to read some of his scriptures, some of the things he was hard on people that would exploit the needy. He said, you oppress the poor and you crush the needy. And in Hebrew law, in the law in Leviticus, well, it's the Hebrew word hesed, which we translate usually loving kindness or mercy, compassion. Translators say there's so much in that word, it's hard to find one English word that describes it. But mercy, loving kindness, compassion, all is tied up in that word hesed. Remember in Leviticus, I'm sure you all are all caught up on your civil laws in Leviticus, but if you remember, there were always laws for the poor. When the people would glean in their fields, you leave a little for the poor. You pick the grapes from the vineyard, you leave a little bit for the poor. And you know the interesting thing I noticed? In these laws, it just said, this is what you do to care for the poor. There was never any statement about, did they deserve it or not? It's just, the poor you always have with you. And it is our job to care for them, whether they deserve it or not. Jesus, all through the Gospels, he was moved with compassion. And he even taught the story in the Good Samaritan. Remember the rich young ruler who came to him and said, who is my neighbor? And Jesus said, well, let me tell you a story. And he told the story of the Good Samaritan. And he was saying, this is the neighbor. This is the person. A neighbor is a neighbor nearby, someone who is right there in front of you. And they were thinking, well, the people I need to help are the people that look like me. And I read an interesting story last night. I wish I had time to do it today. But on a contemporary telling of the Good Samaritan. And basically it went like this. We all understand that story and think, we can't believe the priest and the Levite went by the man who was beat up and about to die on the side of the road. And then a Samaritan came and took care of him. But to them, it's as if I tell you a story and I say, a man was dying on the side of the road and a Baptist preacher and a professor from DTS walked by him and said, I've got meetings to go to. But an atheist stopped and got out of the car and said, somebody's got to do something. Bandage up his wounds, puts him in his car, takes him to Baylor emergency room. Now, would that get your attention? Yeah, that's what Jesus was saying. And he was saying, it is our job to care for those who are near us, our neighbor. It's this command we have. James tells us, pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit the orphans and widows of this world in their trouble and keep oneself unspotted from the world. Remember this, he goes on to say, if a brother or sister is naked or hungry, don't just pat them on the back and say, well, bless you, have a good day. No, it's pity plus action. Give them something to eat. Give them something to wear. And I say all this, and let me tell you this as we conclude. You cannot meet every physical need of people. There's no way. Even all the Christians, of all the Christian charities there are in the world, we cannot even begin to meet all the needs. But I would challenge you to ask the Lord to show you, if you're not involved in any kind of ministry like that, what can you do little, just right now, you? I've found a great outlet for that in World Vision. Just went to an exhibit last week on AIDS, children with AIDS, whose parents have died of AIDS. Whether it's that, whether it's a church benevolent ministry, I have a friend that we travel with sometime, and he would always stop and give beggars on the road some money, a dollar. no matter what. And people in our group would say, don't give that to them. You know, they're alcoholics. But he would wait until everybody wasn't looking. After a few times, he was kind of rebuked. And I would notice him lagging behind, and he'd hand them some money. So I told him, I said, I will be your beggar alert. And I will see the beggars, and I will alert you so you can get your money out. And this last year we went to Israel, we did that, just thinking about him. That was a good example. That was a good example to me. I don't know why they're poor and they're beggars, and maybe they are sick and alcohol. I don't know. But you know what? That's not my job to fix them. All I know is they're hungry and they need money. And God knows. You know what? God knows. So I think our challenge is to realize, but it's not just enough to minister and have pity on their poverty or their needs, but also on their spiritual needs. And sometimes compassion isn't just the poor of the world that are dying and uneducated and all of that, but it might just be the person in the cubicle next to you who needs some compassion. Need somebody to extend a little grace, a little understanding, a little kindness their way. Compassion is not just reserved for the poor and the needy. Sometimes I think we can romanticize that. But there is something we can do with the people that are nearby, our neighbors.